This is the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. Join us as Canada's cinematographers discuss the tools and techniques they use in shaping the aesthetics of their current projects.
This podcast features Todd Dim, CSC, in conversation with Carolyn Wong of the CSC. This interview was recorded on March 8th, 2019, in Toronto, Ontario.
So, Todd, nice to meet you. I'm really glad I could catch you in Toronto on a job. So first, I wanted to congrats on you receiving your letters last year.
Yes, in December.
Great. And on this year, your 2019 nomination for the Fritz Spiess Award for Commercial Cinematography,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's exciting.
For the Subaru Skyline spot.
And you've won before, though.
Yes, I have, yeah.
That's why I know your name.
Yeah, so I've won four CSCs and been nominated for fifth, so this would be, I guess, my sixth nomination since 2012. I'm just so happy all the time. I mean, I remember the first year I submitted was at the encouragement and pressure of my agent, Dora Sessler, at the time. And they're like, no, you have to submit. And I'm like, but I don't got anything that's good enough. And they're like, you never know. And it's not for you to decide. So I submitted. And I remember I got an email saying, hey, you've been nominated for a CSC award. And my immediate reaction was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, because I was thinking, oh, there's probably like 25, 30 people that got nominated. It's going to be this like giant pool of people. Then I looked at the list and I'm one of five or six people. And on that list, I'm still trying to remember the list off the top of my head, but I'm almost confident that I assisted all of the other ones, maybe for the exception of one. Chris Mabley, I think, was the only one that hadn't assisted.
That's great.
But the rest I had assisted. So I'm like, this is amazing. I've been nominated, and then everybody else I've been nominated for, I'd loaded film for at one point.
That's great.
Yeah, so it was really amazing. And then you're like, okay, well, this is a one-off experience. And then...
Actually, this would be a good jumping off that you obviously were in AC before. So how did you, get onto your career as a DP? Where did you start?
I was always shooting. So as soon as I learned how to, basically what a camera did, I started shooting.
So you didn't go to film school?
No, I have no film school. I did...
Self-taught then?
Yeah, pretty much. I did, I had black and white photography classes in high school and in college. So I had a basic understanding of, the fundamental elements of photography. But that was about it. I just really wanted to be a filmmaker. When I moved out to Vancouver, I wanted to get into film. And I was like, okay, well, I could go to Vancouver Film School. But I met a bunch of people that worked on set. And they're just like, no, dude, if you want to be in film, just become a PA and figure out what you want to do. I always knew I wanted to be a cameraman. So that was easy. But so then I started PAing in commercials. And I met now a really close friend of mine who's also a shooter and director who's really talented, Julie Kim, on a commercial. And she taught me how to load mags on freebies and short films. And then that transitioned to getting into the trainee program in 669. I did that. But as soon as I learned what a meter was and how to meter and how to do things, I just was shooting stuff on the side. And it was... And to be honest with you, it was terrible. It was bad. A lot of it was bad. I did not start super amazing DP. So, because you go on a set and you watch these talented people do amazing things, and then you try to copy it. You're just copying what they did, which isn't appropriate maybe for the environment that you're in or the subject matter. So you start just... It's just a trial of process and error. And so I started doing that in probably 2002, 2003. And then I just kept loading on film. I mainly worked in commercials, and I liked commercials in Vancouver's because we had all the big DEPs coming through. So I'd be loading films for Bob Richardson, for Claudio Miranda, Hamish Kaminsky, and the list goes on of people that I would get to watch work. And some of the work was really creative, and other times it was just, technical. But it was great to be in a room with these people and watch them work.
So that's great. So you actually had kind of a mentor.
Sort of, yeah.
Juliet, that sort of...
Julie Kim, yeah. She helped me out a lot in the beginning. And then, you know, later on, like other ACs that I worked for, Toby Armit, and the list goes on of people that have continued to support me, yeah.
Where did you find your first sort of genre, like the jobs you were getting? Because since you were assisting in commercials, did you kind of start shooting commercials first?
No, not at all, no. Because this was also all film, right? Mm-hmm. So the days were different back then. And you had to really prove yourself. And trying to convince somebody to give you 10,000 feet of film to shoot their project was near impossible. No one was going to take the risk. So, and actually one of my posts on Canadian Cinematographer Instagram was about my beginning. And so at the time, I'm like, well, I need to learn how to shoot film. I need to get better. So I started shooting stills. And because I could get a little strobe kit or a kino kit, and I could start lighting faces and people in my little 400 square foot apartment. And then, so that's how I started. And then I got into shooting live festivals. So I would start traveling around North America, and I was shooting, I'd do panoramics of all the stages, like Coachella in California, Sasquatch and Washington. And then I came out here even to do Virgin Festival. And then
right, still, so you were doing
still? All still work, all shooting medium format film and 35 mil panoramics. And I would just literally, at the time, I would go to the photography store. I would go to the expired film section. I'd buy 40 rolls of film. And then I would be in the desert, and I'd be at Coachella. And I'd just reach in my bag when I was done a load of film, and whatever film it was, I just put it in there. I'd listed it on the outside. I'd push it two stops, pull it two stops, cross-process. And I'd just, like, make notes in just in the heat of it. I'd just be like, okay, I'm going to do that with this film. And I'd have these notes later on. I could go back and figure out what worked and what didn't work. And I would just do that. I'd go through, like, probably, like, between 30 and 40 rolls per festival. Great. And then I would come back, get them developed, and then I would scan all the negs myself. And that's how I learned.
Right, and you could apply that to your motion picture.
Yeah, films. So then, and yeah, then, so all the people, yeah, so then all the people that I met through this time, I started shooting music videos, you know, because, like, there's just a bunch of young guys all just trying to, like...
Find their place.
And I'd be like, yeah. And then all of a sudden, I would be loading film in Vancouver on commercials because I had to pay the rent. And then I would fly off to, like, New York and shoot music videos for REM, or, you know, I did some live stuff with different bands, Arcade Fire and LCD Sound System, and I would go off and do all these other projects, and then I'd fly back to Vancouver and I would load film in between jobs.
That's great.
Because
I like
nobody
that.
Would hire me.
Right.
Because either my work was, like, too rock and roll at the time, or I was unheard of, or people weren't, you know, this was early, mid 2000s, and people weren't as willing to take a chance.
So who did it? Like, was there a job that maybe helped, gave you that exposure or that break?
Yeah, I think it was when I did the REM video. People were like, I remember people asking me, how'd you do that? How'd you, as a second assistant, become a DP for this video in New York? And I'm like, well, because you only know me on set as this. But every time I leave here, I go out and I'm a photographer and I'm a DP everywhere else. And so those people only know me as that person. So I was kind of living this dual life. And then eventually I just realized that I needed to figure it out. Like, I just needed to make that transition. I needed to just do it. And I had the support of Michael Haldane at Film Group, who started throwing me little tiny jobs. And then those tiny jobs led to other jobs. And then, you know, then they started getting good. Mm-hmm. You know, I started getting better. And then, yeah, I always try to push things a little bit. Now, I'm much more refined with my abilities, both as a DP and as a collaborator. So I'll never push people outside of what the expectations are for the project, but I will always certainly try to see what I can get away with creatively by pushing it, by trying to make people go into new areas. And so as a result, you start producing more interesting work, even if the work isn't that necessarily that interesting. But people go, oh, this guy, he just didn't come in and just point a light at something. He thought about it. I always put a lot of thought in what I do. and I put a lot of consideration, and I don't, and so as a result, you start getting known as that person that puts thought into things, and that will push the boundaries, and so I think the people that seek me out for exactly that reason, and then the people that I don't work with, probably for the same reasons, don't want to work with me. They just want a guy who comes in and does what they need to do, and I think that's really great too.
So what was the REM song, the music video?
We shot it on a P2. Yeah, I have it on my Vimeo page, so I'm okay, happily right. Even will link it out, okay, if you want. Yeah. I love showing my early work. Because I think it, to me, it shows where you come from and who you are, and it's mm-hmm. also, I think it's hopeful to the next generation of DPs who feel this pressure that everything they do has to be brilliant immediately from the get-go. And that's just the exception of the rule. Some people will grab a camera and be brilliant. The rest of us have to work really, really hard. And so I like showing earlier work. I like talking about the beginning more than I like talking about where I am now, because I think it's more interesting.
So you said that you'd always wanted to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
So, you know, where do you get that motivation? What? I'm just curious, like, how would you know as a young child filmmaker, did you know you wanted to be a cinematographer, or you just knew you wanted to make films?
Yeah, I think I wanted to. So there's this really crazy memory that I have where I grew up the youngest of five. So I often was raised by babysitter TV, right? So, and I had, having older brothers and siblings, I was being exposed to a lot of films. Because there's 12 years difference between me and my oldest brother. So now I'm watching, you know, I'm watching stuff that at like 6 years old that an 18-year-old is interested in.
Right. So your culture.
So my culture is
broader.
Is much broader as a result. And so I remember in grade four, we had this one project where everybody has to go, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I always remembered, and it sounds made up, but I always remember seeing cinematographer in the credits. And in grade four, I wrote that down and terribly misspelled it. But it's so crazy that that always kind of stuck out, right? And I didn't really know what that meant, but I just remember seeing it in the credits. And so watching movies, E.T., I remember being my first film that I watched that I was just like completely blown away by. It just changed my whole world. And then, mm-hmm. you know, and then so you start, and that was like, I was 6, 7, 8 years old, and that was it. You know, I got into, like, I started skateboarding. I was pretty good, but I wasn't like the best. So then I started, everybody who's good, but not as good as the other guys, start filming their friends. And then, you know, and then the same, I was in a band, and I was talented, but I was far from the best musician. So then what do? You start taking pictures of your friends who are in bands. And I was doing that at 16, 17, 18. And I was also doing it at a time when I was shooting video. I was shooting on a VHS cassette. And when I was shooting pictures, I was shooting on the K1000 classic camera. That's like the K1000. I was shooting on that. I didn't really understand. Like, I just set it to automatic on it. There was, you just dial at A. And most of the roles came back with nothing on it, and I didn't know why, because I had no training. And but that's how it, and then it just kept transitioning that way. And I should have probably went to school and for film, but I didn't. And, you know, in retrospect, maybe if I did go back to film school, I think I would like to do, like, an AFI thing or something like that, or maybe just film study to understand film from an intellectual academic standpoint as opposed mm-hmm. to a technical standpoint, because I really feel the technical, anybody can learn it. It's just repetition. It's just, you know, it's a muscle memory. And so for me, I'm much more interested in always talking about why we're doing something, not how we're doing something. And so that's always what I talk about.
Mm-hmm. When you're connecting with the director just to find.
Yeah, why is the camera moving? Why is it moving? Mm-hmm. Okay, so if it's moving, great. So how is it moving now? Is it handheld? Is it dolly? Is it, you know, and when are we moving it? Is it moving all the way through? Is there a particular line or moment that we want to accentuate? That's what gets me excited about filmmaking. And that can happen on commercials. It can happen in music videos. It can happen in narrative. And that's what gets me excited. I just want to get into the meat of it. And then everything else you figure out.
Well, that's, you know, talking about camera movement, I'd like to talk about your short film Dawn that you shot.
Yes.
Because it's so visually strong and it's very poetic. The 61st CSC Awards, it actually won the Best Cinematography in a Short Film, which totally deserved it. Now, when you're talking about motivation for moving, like that film, you know, I think it's the second shot. You know, if you can recall, the beginning, you see the man and then he's at the window and they move to the window and then we just have the window in frame and then there's this little move in.
Yeah.
And it kind of sets the pace for the whole film.
Yeah.
So how did that project come to you? Because it's just a beautiful film.
Well, I'm actually working with the director right now. We're shooting a commercial together.
That's great.
So, yeah, so he's in town. And so that was with Jørgen Throfell. I met him. I did a commercial with him, I want to say like 6 years ago, maybe longer. And then we just connected, and that's it. And we've been everywhere together. And he did other short films, but when Dawn happened, he asked me, and I freaked out. I was so grateful that, because he works with some of the best DPs working in the globe. Like, his list of collaborators is quite high. So to be asked specifically to shoot Dawn, I didn't take lightly. And I'm like, I have to deliver. So we talked a lot about a lot of stuff.
Just give it briefly. What it's about is
it takes place on the day before the first nuclear blast, the Trinity test,
in New Mexico.
Yeah. And so when they did this test in New Mexico, they did it without warning any of the locals. Nobody knew this was happening. As a result, there's people that are just living their lives in the New Mexico desert in the late 1940s, who now all of a sudden wake up to a nuclear blast happening in their backyard. So this particular story follows an elderly farmer whose wife had passed away the year before, and a young Native boy, and it's just their parallel universe and their parallel experience. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of a coming together, end.
Yeah, because so. I kind of saw it that the older man, mm-hmm. maybe passed during the blast. Mm-hmm. Forewarning the boy, and then at the end, is the boy grown up because he survived it?
Well, that's, yeah, okay. So there is a present day element to it. And then ultimately, you know, the young boy who ultimately ends up dying at the end is as a result of the contamination mm-hmm. that had happened.
Exactly. Good. Yes. I got it.
Yes. You did, which is amazing because most people don't. And I don't get even that opportunity to get far into it.
You have to just slow down and, you know, and get rid of those expectations.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean. Those opening shots just set the pace. And I've been to New Mexico and I love it. So it's just amazing. Get it. So, I mean, it doesn't look lit, which is like the goal in a sense. Yeah. Like, I don't see it because it looks all naturalistic, but you must talk about, like, you know, how did you guys decide?
You always go into a particular project, I think, having some sort of rules or guidelines on how you want to execute it. So my initial approach was, there's two parts of the story. There's when the blast happens, the world has forever changed. So my thought was, before the blast, let's shoot everything available light. And then after the blast, I can light anything I want, because meaning is analog, explosion, digital, past, new. That's what my mindset was. So when I went into anything before that blast happened, I really tried not to light.
It was dark. There's some dark stuff there.
Yeah, but I shot it at exposure, knowing we would bring it down. So it wasn't nearly as dark on set as it was in the final film. And I don't normally do that, and I don't normally recommend doing that. But the reason I did was because I knew that Jørgen and I would have creative control on the final image, and no one was going to come in and tell us that we couldn't bring it down. So I had trust that what I wanted to do was best for the image. So I approached it differently. So now, did I light? Yes. I had to break that rule. And I had to because, well, now you're in a location. And this location doesn't have windows where actions are happening. And so what I did for the most part was we did all of the Adobe Hut stuff with the man during high sun. And then I had mirror boards outside of all the windows. And I just took the sun and I bounced it back in. So that was the sun, and it wasn't the actual direction of the sun, but it was always the sun. And I would, whenever possible, that's where I started. I'd be like, okay, well, you know, put a couple mirror boards out there and blast that hard sun. Like, it'd be like hard coming in, and I might diffuse it on the inside, or I might even bounce it a second time on the inside. And so that's where we always started. And then eventually it'd be like, well, he's not separated from the background. Like, I got to give him a little bit of separation. So then we would bring in some light mats, some sky panels, and I would
just a
soft something to give a little bit of separation.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all I would do. It was always just like a little bit of separation from the background. But most of the hard light that you see in it is sun through a window, mm-hmm. through mirror boards.
I mean, yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, when I watch it, the action is taking place near windows. So it seems very naturalistic. Like, yes, if I lived and I didn't have lights inside, I would just do my action around there. The hard light, I'm thinking of that scene at the beginning where he's, I think, grinding coffee or...
Yeah.
And that looks like a nice slash. It works. I mean, I've also been in Adobe, so I know that there could be slashes coming in. And that works.
Yeah, so that particular shot was one of the first shots where I fully had to light that. So I have, you know, up in the roof, I have a light mat, and then I had one off. So what I always try to do is you trick the viewer in thinking the light is motivated. So I would always try to have a light in the background, whether it was a window or a hole in the Adobe hut. So that's a trick. It's like all you do is like, well, if there's a window in the background, you just assume that that light is coming from
it. Justifies
it. It justifies something. It.
Yeah.
It may not actually be the light. And I do it on set all the time. It's like, well, just put a little lamp somewhere near the person, even if it's not. And then I can have this giant, massive lighting setup that's like totally contrived, but it's motive. And then again, if you do it tastefully enough and subtly enough, then you don't think the person's lit, and the motivation is that highlight in the background.
Yeah, the power of suggestion.
The power of suggestion, and that's all I tried to do in there, was I always tried to find compositions that motivated the light. Like, we're sitting here right now, and it's like, well, there's a hard light coming through your window, and then now you have this wall right here, and it's soft, it bounced back to you. This is how I would light this. Mm-hmm. If I came in here, the only difference I would do is I'd put an 18K out there as far away as I possibly can, and then I'd have a different bounce here. I wouldn't light this situation that we're having any differently than the way it is now. I would shape it a little bit more. I might add a little thing in the background.
Something you can control.
You
need to control it a bit.
I want to control it, yeah. But, you know, and that's all I do. Like, I remember this one quote that Vilmos said. And he's like, if you want to be a good DP, and don't quote me on the quote, but it was to the effect, like, observe the natural world. So whenever I'm sitting down and I'm at a cafe or I'm somewhere and I'm like, oh, the light's really nice right now. I'm like, what is it doing? And then I kind of like, oh, the sun's over there. And oh, it's actually like it's going from that window, but it's hitting that pink marble over there and it's giving this really nice warm glow. I'm like, oh, that's really nice. Yeah. And then next time I'm like doing something, I'm like,
memory.
Yeah, I'm just like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to. I just try to bounce the light around. I try to shape it. I try to, like, make it not go to places I want it to go. And that's really all I try to do. And even if I'm making it stylized and I try to have my stuff have a style to it, it's always grounded in reality. And you can still have saturated colors. You can have pinks and blues, but you need motivation for it. Yeah. Otherwise, it just becomes self-serving or something
like
that.
You need thesis behind it. And I think that is, key to lighting is to observe real life. Observe it, because sometimes real life is actually more fictional, you know, than what you make up.
It's
like,
really
someone
strange.
Won't believe it. It's like, well, I've seen that, so actually I'm going to light it like that because I have seen it and it does happen.
Okay, well, here's an example of this, that I have this conversation all the time. I live in Vancouver. It rains a lot there. And you know what? It can be both sunny and rainy at the same time. That is a real thing that I experience regularly in my life. Now cut to me on a commercial set, and I'm sitting there, and it's a little bit rainy out, and I'm like, okay, well, just pull out the 18K and just hit it hard, and you get this nice light, and you get this nice warm light, and then but you get this rain, and it's like amazing. And they're like, that doesn't happen in real life. And I go, it happens in real life all the time. In real life, that happens. But in movie life, that doesn't happen. So I don't know. I always, like, I'm just like, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. And sometimes I've even been like, look, it's happening right now. It's sunny over there. It's raining over there. And look at, they're coming together in the middle. It's beautiful. You know, and you always, you know, those are decisions you ultimately have to decide how you want to fight that. But that's something that I think about all the time is that, well, I'm always like, yeah, if it happens, and even if it doesn't happen, you know, you just want to try to find a good enough reason to be doing a certain process.
The boy riding the horse in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
When was that shot? Was there any filtration? Was there any? Did you darken that?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We brought that down probably three stops.
So did you shoot it? At, like,
so
what time of day?
So we had to. So we shot it as soon as the sun went down. We couldn't have direct sun, right? Mainly because also where they were riding, it would have been a tell. So we had to do the whole horse riding scene. We had to do in 45 minutes, all in three locations that were all about a kilometer away from each other. So the first one where the horse comes up over, there's a 100-foot dolly track that tracks with it, and then it goes off in the distance.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to the second shot where we're tracking with it, and there's a little bit of a handheld situation. So those two particular shots had to happen. We're like, okay, well, this is when we have no exposure anymore. So the second one, where it's a little bit handheld, we're tracking along with the horse, that was pretty much what it was. Like, we shot until there was no exposure. We did that multiple times. But we had to work backwards schedule-wise. So we're like, okay, so the sun goes down here. We have to be there in 30 minutes, and we only have 10 or 15 minutes where we can roll on it. So, yeah, so you had to make that decision. And so it was just a logistical thing. So, you know, we had 100-foot track that we had laid down that we rehearsed in full sun. We're sweaty. It's hot. We're just waiting for the sun. You know, we had a little camera 4x4 thing with a bungee rig on the back. And then
The long dolly?
No, for the second shot where we were tracking with the horse. And so we're just sitting there getting rigged, and we're practicing. Like, we're just sitting there practicing for like an hour because, you know what I mean? Like, and we're dealing with horses, we're dealing with stunt people. Oh, it was a stunt person.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had like a little stunt woman that had long hair who was doing all the fast riding of the horse. He was on the horse on the rest of it, but when it was just that, like, when the horse was really, really going, we had a stunt person for that. So, you know, there's a lot of moving parts. There's stunt people, there's animal wranglers, there's dolly, you know, luckily we had two cameras, so we could have both cameras on both, and we just rehearsed it. We knew exactly what we were going to do, and it's the hardest game, and it's, you're sitting there, and the AD's like, so can we roll? And I'd be like, we can't. we've talked about this.
Yeah.
When the sun goes down, in 15 minutes, we can roll. Okay. 7 minutes later, so can we roll now? And I'd be like, my answer is the same. I'm happy to say it, but it's the same. And I know it disappoints you, but I promise you I'll keep saying the same thing. And if you guys want to roll, I'll roll. But it's not the time. And Yearn was just absolutely adamant that we do everything at the right time.
Yeah,
and so I had his support.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because what happens is I think a lot of times production will then start going after the director. Then the director feels pressure to then roll. And then that then gets put on me. You know what I mean? I'm like, this is what we all agreed upon, so let's just do it. And if for some reason we all decide that we want to change it, then we can, but we have to get everybody involved. You know, it's...
So that was the... just talking about cameras and the technical aspects.
Yeah.
Was that maybe the one time you had two cameras and everything else seemed like it was a single camera?
Everything was single camera. The only reason we had two cameras was because to take the camera off of the dolly, then rig it onto this bungee rig, and then get over to the other place. It was a one-camera shoot. We just had two cameras because sometimes...
For expedience sake.
Yeah, because a lot of Dawn, all of it was timing. Like, I had all the sun pass everywhere. So we were never rushing. We weren't in a hurry because we had a lot of time. Like, we shot it over 6 days. So we had a lot of time, but we also was like, yeah, we have... Once we're there, we would do everything that we need to do. We would rehearse the hell out of it. And then we would just wait 45 minutes for the sun to be where it needed to be. And so how we were able to do that, basically, I think we shot 6 days. the first 2 days, and I'm doing air quotes that you guys can't see, but we had like a full crew, you know, like I had grips and gaffers and stuff like that. And then the third and fourth day, we went down to, you know, essential crew. And then on the last 2 days, it was just Jurn and I in a pickup truck driving around shooting landscapes. So all of the landscape shots were just him and I in a pickup truck for two days.
All the sunsets.
Yeah, we'd wake up at 4 a.m, we'd shoot all the sunrises, then we would wait till sun would go down, and then we would shoot, you know, 2 or 3 more sunsets, and we did that 4 times. And then so we had a combination, and we would find the best locations where we could simply go, okay, boom, there, that's amazing. Now pan over this way and do this one. So it was all like we had, you know, sticks in the ground off the side of the highway. And, you know, there's a few times where we had a couple electric lines and some fences that had to be painted out on post because, you know, like sometimes we could go on the other side of the fence and sometimes you couldn't.
And in Arizona, you want to be careful.
You want to be
You don't want to be trespassing.
You don't want to be on the wrong side of the fence down there. So a lot of times we were just like, that, you know, the lens would be over top of like a barbed wired fence, and that's how we shot a lot of those landscapes and stuff.
What did you shoot it on? What lenses?
We had 4 lenses. We had the Hoxie series, which are my favorite lenses. They're older. I think they're from like the 70s or 80s. We had three. And then we had 4, one showed up broken, so then we had to replace one with a Hawk V-Light, so we had one newer lens.
These are primes.
They're all primes, so we had 4 prime lenses on the Alexa Mini, and that was basically it. That was like, we had sticks, hi-hat, and an O'Connor head. I'm coming up from a camera, being camera savvy, being an assistant that worked for some of the biggest DPs out there, I always see how a lot of people weigh themselves down with gear. I just don't do it. I get the right amount of gear to do the job. That might mean we have a ton of gear, because that's what the project means, but give me a couple lenses and a camera and get out of my way and I can make some amazing stuff. And I think that's because of my experience as going around and shooting all these festivals and just having a light meter and a pouch and 2 cameras and just being like, okay, where's the angle? Like, where can I find the shot? And how can I make this special? And what separates this from there? And so whenever I'm doing a film, I just always want the least amount of gear I can have to get away with the job.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really a camera heavy DP.
So you did the transition from film to digital.
Yeah, I love digital.
I'm open
about it. I'm very open. I love it. I think it's great.
And do you still bring your meter to set? Like, what do you use?
I have my same monitor, my onboard monitor, small HD, that I've been traveling with for probably about 4 years now. The first 6 months of that transition to start using my monitor lighting, I would set all of my ratios and all of my stops off my meter. And I did that for probably 6 months. And then I started putting my meter away and I started lighting by eye. And I would set the stop and then I'd pull my meter out. And I started noticing that I was within a third of a stop. And I was like, okay.
Right, you can let go of that.
I don't need it. Like, you know what I mean? Because what happened is my eye started refining to my monitor. So I think one of the questions was, what's the one tool that you travel with? And mine is my monitor. I won't do a job without my monitor.
That makes total sense.
Because you only
have control.
That's the
only thing you can have control
of. Because I'm so used to that image. And my philosophy is, if I can make my little onboard monitor look good, it's only going to get better later on. Once you get all of that information and you sit down in a colorist and you're looking at it at that level, it's only going to get better. So all I try to do on set is look at my monitor and be happy.
I like that.
That's it. I'm just like, this looks good. Great. It's only going to get better. Could it be better on set? Could I have a better monitor? Yes. But I don't need that. I only need to know that this is good enough. Because again, well, if I want a better monitor, then now I need a bigger monitor. Now if I'm traveling to China or wherever I'm going. Now I'm traveling. Like, it just keeps... No, I just have this little monitor that I can throw into a carry-on bag, plug into any camera. I have every single cable and every single mount that I fit in a little pouch. And I can show up and I can plug it into whatever. And I know that if I'm happy looking at that, then I'm fine.
Do you think at some point that monitor will need upgrading or become 100%. Obsolete?
And then no, absolutely. And it's probably soon. It'll probably happen very soon. And I'm fine with it.
And what make it? Who makes it?
Small HD. It's the high bright.
Right.
And it's a great monitor, and I probably will replace it. And when I replace it, I'll go back to my meter, and I'll do that process again.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you own any other equipment at all? Or
I own a ton of stuff, yeah.
Oh, do you?
I didn't own gear coming up, but I started buying gear when I started traveling because there's a lot of bad gear out there. I might have a little bit of gear on set. I may not be a gear-heavy DP when it comes to camera, but everything has to be good, and everything has to be working. And this is the one part where I have zero patience for bad gear. We pay a lot of money for this gear. It rents for a lot of money. It has to be working. It has to perform because I have to perform and I have to deliver.
Right. They're your
and
tools.
I can't turn around and tell the director or the producer that the gear that's been provided isn't sufficient enough for me to do the job. All they care about is that the image looks the way they want it to look. So I have zero patience for bad gear. So as a result, I built what I call my super case, my case of solutions.
I like that, the case of solutions.
Yeah, it's just accessories. So I have my map box that clips on, that I have every single clip-on ring to. I have my filters. Because you can go up to a rental house in some small region and you ask for a set of filters, and every filter is from a different company, from a different year, from a different vintage. Mm-hmm. And every time you're changing the filter, the people are like, well, why is our product look different than it did 2 minutes ago? So I have my filters, my map box. I have a Preston follow focus because I have no patience for bad follow focus. I have my Easy Rig. I have an Airy director's finder. And then I have like all these little custom mounting plates. So I can mount my gear onto pretty much any configuration that exists. And a lot of the things that I've, these little things that I've had, I've designed them and had them machined specifically for cameras. So when I show up, it's like, it's a little body, it's a lens, it's a little clip-on map box if I need it. Even then, I don't even use map boxes if I don't need to. I'll just shoot. Like Dawn, I didn't have any map boxes because the way the C-Series works is that the front element, actually when it focuses, it rotates. So then you'd have to go to a studio map box and have a bellows that a cloth bellows that goes in and out as it's pulling focus. Well, I have no patience for studio map boxes. So all I did was get 138 NDs and I would clip it onto the front. So then as as we were focusing, the lens was circular and it would just go in and out as we were pulling focus. And then I just had a French flag for flares. Great, boom. So it's like I just have my lens, my body, my monitor. That's it. No eyepiece. I almost never use the eyepiece.
Right.
And that just comes to the fact that I feel like as DPs, all we do is stare at monitors really close. That also now taking a monitor and putting it 2 inches from my eye and staring at it intently is not good for my vision. So I'm always like, I try to have the monitor away as far as I possibly can without it being too far away. So I'm always trying to find that balance of like, how far can I get my monitor away when I'm operating? You know, and I'm like I said, like I just got glasses 6 months ago because I've been staring at monitors for the last decade and a half,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
So yeah, so that's sort of that's it. Like I just want a monitor, I want the lens, I want the body, I want the least amount of gear I possibly can.
And your case of solutions.
Have it, yeah.
I love that.
So I travel with it. I travel less with it now than I used to, but I still travel with it quite a bit. Oh, and I have my Easy Rig, which I don't use as much as I used to.
Hmm.
I've learned that the Easy Rig isn't always the right solution. Mm-hmm. So I use it for... I used to use it for every single time I was handheld. And now I think I use it for maybe a third of my handheld work.
But I think that's it. Is using something like so much that you know it.
I know
it's
it.
It's like film stock. It's like lenses. Yeah. You know, yeah. When you were doing your stills, because my background is in stills. It's like I shot for a year black and white. I shot for a year on transparencies.
Yeah.
So I knew exactly.
Yeah.
What the tool, the film stock would be if I needed to do something.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the same with like cameras for me. It's like, yeah, I'll talk about technical until I'm blue in the face, but I find it boring. And so, but you know, cause I think there's so many other things to talk about, but yeah, I know the cameras. Like I've always been an Arri person. So even when I was shooting on film, I was shooting on Arri 3s and 435s and 416s and 235s and Arri cams and all. I was always an Arri guy. Not any other particular reason than when I was coming up, Danny Claremont, now Keslo, but Claremont at the time, was unconditionally supportive of my career and would give me SR3s to go shoot music videos. So I just got really used to Arris.
Arris are great. Workhorses.
They're amazing. Yeah. They're really amazing. I'm shooting some... I'm going to be shooting a feature on film coming up and... which will be great and exciting and stuff like that. But yeah, immediately it was like, oh yeah, it was just like, okay, what Arri camera do we want and figure that out. It was like no other options. And so I'm loyal. Like I shoot on the Red. I have no problems with the Red. But I'm an Arri person. I'm very comfortable with it. I know that camera so well. I know how far I can push it beyond even what people would think is acceptable. Like I even have sometimes, you know, you end up, and sorry for my language, you get into the shit as a DP and you just got to get an exposure. I know what I can do to get an exposure where even ACs and dits come up and they're like, I'm just like, dude, I do this all the time. It's going to be fine. I promise you, I appreciate you coming up and always come up and always tell me when you have concerns. I always want to hear everyone's concerns. I just may not necessarily be swayed by their concerns because I know what this camera can do. I know how far I can push it.
Yeah, and teaching them something too.
That, yeah, you know. I'm like, you can do this. Like people are like, oh, what do you do? Like, do you push? Do you pull the ASA? What do you? I'm like, yeah, I do it all the time.
Right.
So I used to like, you know, I'd be like, okay, well, I'm only going to shoot 800 ASA. And then I'd be like, oh, no, I'm only going to, you know, no, maybe I'll shoot, you know, 1600 ASA. Now I'm just like, if I'm in a hurry and we're behind, I won't even change a filter. I'll just dial the ASA down to 160. I don't care. I'll do it for one shot in a sequence of shots where I did it at different ASAs. And you know what? Nobody notices. Nobody cares. I just, whatever I got to do to get the shot
I like that.
And the amount of time that I need, I just do it now. I don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. And now I just, like, I'm just like, yeah, if I have time and we got nothing to do, I'll change a filter. No problem. How much time does it take to change a filter? But you know on set when everybody's all like getting all crazy and they don't want to wait anymore. Last thing I want to say to people that are all stressed out because we're losing time is, oh, I need to put an ND3 in. No, I'll just go down to 400 ASA. That's totally
efficient.
Who cares?
Yeah, it's totally efficient.
Who cares? It makes no difference. These cameras are brilliant. They're so good. And then when I need stop, I'm like, the first thing I do if I need an extra stop is I don't go to ASA. I go to shutter. I just open it up. I go 356 immediately. First thing I do. I'll be like, oh, I need another stop. I just open the shutter at 356. And all of a sudden, all the nerds come running up. They're like, aren't you worried about motion blur? And I'm like, the camera's static and the person's sitting on a couch.
Right. You read the situation.
What's going on right now? And you know what? I've done it where I've been handheld and following people. And you know what? Still nobody noticed. Nobody notices. You notice that the shutter on the other end of it, if you're going 90 and 45 and so on, yeah, you'll notice it right away. But you don't notice it the other way if you start opening it up. You never notice
That's
it. So everybody listening, I tell you, you don't notice it. And if you do, whatever you're watching isn't interesting enough or amazing enough that you're paying attention to it. Because all that matters is what's happening on the screen. How is
That's
the
right.
viewer reacting to it?
And the narrative should be taking you away and I shouldn't be noticing anything else.
You shouldn't be noticing anything else. And that's what I always strive to do is, mm-hmm. is don't pay attention to this other stuff. And then, you know, then I'll be like, oh, actually, I need a little bit more. 360, you know, 356 isn't doing it. So I got to, you know, now I need to, okay, I'll go to, like, I'll just start going 1,000 of it. Yeah, it's getting there. Yeah, 1,200. Okay, that's great. 1,600, I start slowing down a little bit. I'm like, nah. But if you're shooting raw, I'll just start at 1,600. And then often also pushing and pulling. So if I'm shooting darker stuff and I still have to stop, I pull everything. So my first short film, Rue, that also won a CSC award, I had plenty of stop. So I shot most of that at like 160, 200. I was pulling because I was protecting for the darks. And then if I'm outside and we're shooting and it's snowy and there's white everywhere, I'll tend to start pushing. So I'm protecting for the highlights. I treat it exactly the same way I would with film. Mm-hmm. I don't think about it any differently. Oh, and the best thing about digital too is that I have my monitor, I have my waveform, I have my meter, I have my false color, I have a button that I can toggle in between RAW or Log C and or RAW and Rec 709. I'm constantly making sure all of these things align. I'm constantly toggling through all of these things as I'm going along. So I know whether or not things are going to be blowing out or not blowing out, or whether things are being crushed or not crushed. And I'm always taking that in consideration. And if I choose to blow something out, and now I tend to, like, I want to see how far I can blow things out now. I tend to find that I'm like going the opposite. Like, there's like, and most of my work is dark, but that's just because that's what's relevant right now. That's the style of photography. But a lot of work, I'm like, well, how much can I blow that out in the background before they can't bring it back? Mm-hmm. That's what I'm interested in. I want to know how far, like the amount of times I've, just because of pure logistical natures of being on set, how underexposed you've exposed things. And then, you know, 2 days later, you're sitting at a colorist and they're bringing it back and you're like, oh my God, like we were three stops under. We were 3.5, 4 stops under. You can't tell. You can't tell, especially if you're shooting raw. And I don't tend to shoot, I don't always shoot raw. ProRes is good for 95% of the work that I'm doing. And the only time I ever really push for shooting raw is when I know that I have a time and I have the colorist. So if I have the time to sit in color for a long time and play with that extra little bit, and I have a colorist who knows how to what to do with that little bit, then for sure 100% I will shoot raw. But I don't always just default to raw.
But there's definitely more latitude than film.
Yeah, 100%. As somebody who learned how to be a DP shooting film, there's a lot more latitude. And so, because I'm pro-digital doesn't mean I'm anti-film.
No,
and I'm shooting a film on, I'm shooting a feature on film, and I'm very excited for that process. But to me, again, it always comes down to, I'm more excited about the collaboration and the subject matter and the script and all these other things than I am with the medium in which we're capturing it.
That's great.
Funny because I say that a lot, but people are still like, the film is better. And I'm like,
no.
Well, I'm like, better what? Yeah. And then I always say, well, you know, did you watch this movie? And they're like, yeah. And I'm like, well, they shot that digitally. Would it have been even a better movie and you would have liked it even more if they shot on film? No, it didn't matter. The performances is all that matters. Mm-hmm. So when you ask me, I don't always call myself a DP or a cinematographer. I call myself a filmmaker because all I want to do is capture strong, compelling stories and performances. And I want the actors to feel safe. And I want the director to feel safe when they come to me, that I'm not going to be a diva, that I'm not going to get stuck up in some dogmatic process that I have to do it this way. We can't shoot your movie or your thing because we don't have these lenses.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, what do we have on the shelf? I'm going to do a short film in Albuquerque, New Mexico at the end of the month. And, you know, limited resources. So, you know, I reach out to Keslo and I say, hey, you know, I want to shoot on a mini. I would love that. But as far as lenses, what do you have on the shelf that's not working that weekend? Just what do you have? Just tell me the list of lenses that aren't working, and I'll pick a set of those ones. Obviously, I like the Hoxie series. I like these ones. I like there's a lot of lenses I like. But I'm always just like, well, I mean, so if you look at my Instagram, for a long time I would post up like screen grabs from my favorite films, and I would say, okay, what camera do they use and what lenses they use. And it was funny, in doing that exercise, I started realizing that lenses that I didn't like, I started seeing that movies and DPs were using the very lenses that I was convinced that I didn't like, that I didn't think were cinematic. And so doing that, I started going, hold on a second. Lenses aren't cinematic. Cameras aren't cinematic. It's all everything else. It's production design.
Well, and it's framing.
It's framing, it's composition. And the moving. That's cinematic. It's not a lens or a camera or a film stock. I just don't believe that. And so, like, all of a sudden, all these lenses that I used to be, like, snobby about, that I would be like, oh, I would never use those lenses. I'm like, well, it's good enough for that DP and for that director and that brilliant movie that I've watched a dozen times, so it should be good enough for what I'm doing. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
That's how I am. Like, obviously, yeah, I do have lenses I like, and I do have things I'll push for. I'm not a pushover. But I'm also just very open to, like, what do you got? What do you have? Like, what's on the truck?
They probably love you for that.
Yeah, gaffers.
You'll get what you want.
Yeah, a good talk. And then when you do ask for something, they're more likely to give it to you because you're not unreasonable. I go to the gaffer, I'm like, what do you got on the truck? Because gaffers love their toys. And they're like, I got this thing. I got that thing. I'll be like, great, let's try it. And then I'll be like, okay, that sucked. Let's not use it anymore. I'll be like, that's amazing. Now I have something that I can use that I didn't have before. So being open to using whatever gadgets, these grips and camera assistants and all these amazing people that do this all the time with way more amazing people than me on way better projects than I'm doing, I want to know what they have in the truck. I want to know what their thoughts are and approach. And so I'll be like, yeah, I want an Arri Max out there. And they're like, well, we don't have one. I'm like, well, what do you have? They're like, we have an M90. Okay, great. Let's use that then. And they're like, well, we don't even have that because we're in the middle of nowhere. We have an M40. I'm like, okay, great. My ratios get smaller, but I can produce relatively the same results.
Yeah, you can work with
it. I can work with it.
Work with it. That's great.
You know, and so that's what that's why I think I'm still very excited about my job and what I do. And I'm as passionate now than I was 20 years ago, because I don't worry about whether I'm going to mess it up or not. I don't worry about that anymore. What gets me excited is, can I walk into an environment with a bunch of strangers and still make compelling images? That's what gets me excited.
And maybe in closing, any advice you'd give to the young cinematographer, like
yeah.
any little tip, what would you give them in a little sentence, like what to keep in mind?
Don't be afraid to fail, because you will. Just learn from those experiences. Mm-hmm. I said this to you at the beginning of the conversation, is that I was never the most talented, the most creative person in the room, but I never let my failures beat me down. I woke up the next day, I dusted myself off, and I went out and I did it again. And so that's why I'm here right now. And so that's what I say, is don't be afraid to make mistakes, because you will.
That's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Todd.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. This was a pleasure. Anytime.
This has been the Canadian Society of Cinematographers podcast. The CSC is a nonprofit organization that has been promoting the art and craft of cinematography in Canada since 1957. Find out more by logging on to thecsc.ca. Thank you for joining us.